Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 1963 was the year the civil rights movement came of age. Martin Luther King went from discouragement to a sense of near jubilation as white America started to pay attention in new ways. It was good news, bad news all year long. Police Commissioner Bull Connor jailed thousands in Birmingham. Black kids as young as six marched in the streets there. President Kennedy got behind new civil rights legislation and gave a primetime speech. Medgar Evers was gunned down at his home. A Birmingham church was firebombed. And, of course, King marched on Washington and gave his immortal I Have a Dream speech. It was a year of incredible consequence, and here to talk about it are a pair of historians speaking at the Kansas City Public Library the next couple of days at a civil rights symposium. With us this morning, Leon Litwack is an historian and author. He won a National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, and the Francis Parkman Prize for his 1979 book, Been in the Storm So Long, The Aftermath of Slavery. He also received a Guggenheim Fellowship. And Leon, so nice to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also here is Patricia Sullivan of the University of South Carolina. She specializes in modern U.S. history with an emphasis on African-American history, race relations, and the history of the civil rights movement. Pat, nice to have you too.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, Leon, the civil rights movement was beginning to founder just before 1963. Martin Luther King was discouraged. Just how much trouble was the movement in as 1963 began?
It was in trouble, yes. There was in trouble. There was trouble around because there were black people were in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right to say that because some people think of the March on Washington as a celebration. Well, the reason for the March on Washington was that there was nothing to celebrate yet. There were real problems that were not being taken care of, and that the movement wanted to call the attention of the country to these problems and give it as much publicity as possible.
Patricia, Pat, tell us a little more about why the wheels were coming off. You know, why was Martin Luther King so discouraged back in those days?
One of the main reasons is that for all of the protests, high-visibility protests, the sit-ins, the freedom rides, which captured the attention of the nation momentarily, but then the nation turned away. I mean, there really was no, as you pointed out, movement on the part of the Kennedy administration or pressure by the rest of the country for action in facing these issues. And there was good reason. And I think we tell the story of the history of the civil rights movement as an ongoing narrative. But when you look back, the attention of the country sort of ebbed and flowed until we get to 1963.
And we don't think about it that way, do we? We think about it as one sustained thrust,
exactly,
and everybody riveted by what was going on. Yeah. So, Leon, if not for the events of 1963, where does the movement wind up?
Well, where it might wind up, at least, is in a paralysis of the movement. If it's perceived as not going anywhere. There's a good deal of discouragement by this time. I'm not even sure the exact date, but there was a time when Martin Luther King gave a speech, and he found himself for the first time, perhaps, and one of the very few times, he was booed during his speech by a civil rights, predominantly civil rights audience, a black audience. And this obviously had an effect on him. And that night, he wondered about that. And he came to realize that the reason why they were booing is because he had really raised their expectations. He had so raised their expectations that he had found that they were, it was impossible to fulfill them. And he realized this is why they were giving him a hard time now. And that would just give you, that was just an example of the kind of discouragement that was rather prevalent in the movement at that point.
You know, Leon, was he thinking at all seriously about this idea of just giving it up, that this thing is just not going to work?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know, but I don't think so. I think he was much too determined, and the issues before him were far too important for him to even think about
yeah
that possibility.
You know, Pat, so he heads into 1963. We're setting the table here about this year, feeling despondent over the state of the movement. He decides to design and even mount a showdown campaign in Birmingham, Alabama. And he doesn't even tell some of his own aides about what he has planned here. What did he have in mind, and why did he keep it a secret?
Well, you know, he's coming off of a quote-unquote defeat in Albany.
What happened in Albany?
In Albany, well, they went in there and staged protests against segregation, and they were up against a brilliant opponent in Sheriff Jim Clark, who basically arrested people. He just kept jailing people. And, you know,
in Albany, New York, people don't think of...
No, Albany, Georgia.
Georgia, okay.
This is
there
Albany,
we go.
Georgia. But important to turn attention, because the North is in this picture as well. But in Albany, Georgia, and so there was no... And the Kennedy administration, they wanted order. And so Jim Clark did not... There was no physical violence against protesters. They were arrested. And the movement just sort of petered out there. No real leverage in terms of getting the government, the federal government, to act. I think in choosing Birmingham, Fred Shuttlesworth was there, brilliant civil rights leader, and Bull Connor was there. And I think the sense was a massive protest in Birmingham, which was probably the most racially violent and repressive city in the South, would generate some kind of a response and the kind of confrontation that would draw national attention. And he was certainly correct about that.
So he was very strategic in making this pick of Birmingham. He knew some of his own lieutenants wouldn't like the idea, given what you just said, right?
Probably so. That's right. But, you know, Shuttlesworth had laid the groundwork, and he had been there for years. Brilliant strategist. So King had a tremendous partner in him. And so they went forward with that. And it really is the pivotal point, I think, for the civil rights movement.
Birmingham and what happened there. And pivotal because he had to make a strong showing there or else?
In a sense, but also what it triggered in terms of the entire country, the reaction to Birmingham, to the violence in Birmingham, and hundreds
Bombingham,
of...
they called it.
Bombingham,
right.
It forced the country to pay attention because, you know, not only in what you saw with the famous images of the children being attacked by dogs and fire hoses, but after King's Hotel was bombed, in the midst of all this, black people were in the streets and ready to fight back. And as Malcolm X had said, once black people are ready to fight back, the country pays attention. And you had that kind of confrontation in Birmingham.
You know, there's a central figure, Leon, in Bombingham, as you just mentioned, a man named Bull Connor,
yes.
Who goes down in history as one of the great bad guys of all time. He was the Birmingham police commissioner. Tell us about him. What kind of formidable force was he?
Well, Bellamy, he'd actually been around for a long time. We sometimes don't understand that. He was around when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president.
Wow.
And he wrote to Roosevelt once, and he said, isn't fighting one war against Germany enough? Do you really want to fight another war?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way he felt about the challenge of black Americans. And he was determined that they would not win, and that if he had to fight that war, he would fight that war on behalf of the white people of Birmingham.
And he would fight that war by what? Just arresting every African-American he saw, right?
By terrorists, using terrorist tactics if necessary.
What do you mean terrorist tactics?
Well, meaning the terrorized people instead of just simply, I mean, terrorize and frighten people, not just simply arrest them, but make it extremely difficult for them in every way possible.
And, Pat, there's a decision that the movement makes here at some point to enlist young people to march in Birmingham. Extremely controversial. Yes. Why was the decision made, and what happened there?
Well, by that point, Bull Connor had sort of kept his cool, and so many adults had been arrested. I mean, it was sort of taking on an Albany-like, and there weren't people to protest in large numbers. And so the decision to use the children, to bring the children into the protests. Well, I'm sure many of these children were ready and active in their families, but it was controversial. But in the end, it was something that that brought Birmingham to the point where it created this crisis and this moment of bringing the movement into the nation's attention.
And again, just to clarify, kids as young as 6 years old marching in the face of this kind of terror, to use Leon's word, in Birmingham, just an amazing sight to see even pictures today of what was happening down there.
That's right. But, you know, prior to the children's participation, Connor had not reacted with the kind of violence that he did then, with the hoses and the dogs and all of that. So it was a tipping point.
Why did he react against the kids so violently but not the adults?
That's a very interesting question. You know, I think he probably tried to keep his cool because the point of Clark in Albany was you didn't want this to become an event that would draw the media and mm-hmm. images and all of this. And the guy was you know, I think pretty unstable. And so
was he unstable?
I've heard he was not, you know, he was sort of hair trigger, I guess, mm-hmm. and just determined, right, to kind of maintain segregation and he had it. I think he reached a breaking point by the time these masses of children become involved in these daily protests.
And so he obviously overreached here.
He certainly did, yeah.
And I doubt if he'd ever expected the movement to resort to these kind of tactics, mm-hmm. to use children in this way.
He didn't anticipate it.
No, I don't think so, no.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot that white people did not anticipate in Birmingham and elsewhere at this time.
So, Leon, all this news coverage of the Birmingham marches gives Martin Luther King new celebrity here. He visits Cleveland, Ohio, at one point in May of 1963, and he's greeted like he's an astronaut. He's just he's a hero in that northern city of Cleveland. How big a deal does Martin Luther King become in the wake of Birmingham?
Oh, I think he assumes much, you know, his image certainly is given a boost.
Mm-hmm.
He's perceived as someone who is prepared to really turn this country around if necessary,
mm-hmm.
in order to be heard, in order for his people to be heard.
After all, this
is the person who he's not dragged screaming into the movement, but he was not a person who, at the very outset, he had to be persuaded to come into this movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the more he came into it, the more he felt the issues that were involved, the more he was able to respond to the need to give maximum publicity to the movement and to what's going on, what's happening to his people.
Well, the key here in Cleveland, that if I understand right, that it begins to signify, Leon, is this idea that suddenly white America now in mass is paying attention, mm-hmm. and standing up on behalf of King and what he's out trying to accomplish, right?
That's one way of putting it. I'm not so sure the American people were rallying in his support to that degree.
But he's an astronaut in Cleveland as he comes through.
Yeah,
he's as famous as an astronaut.
Well, my take on it at that time still is that there were people who didn't like what King was doing, but who recognized that it was having an effect,
mm-hmm.
and most importantly, having an effect on black Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason alone, they had to pay attention.
Pat, your sense of this moment when Cleveland, he goes to Cleveland and mm-hmm. people paying attention, how significant of a moment is it in your mind?
Very significant. As Leon pointed out, I think white America is diverse and, you know, different responses, but the issue was there. And again, people protest. There were hundreds of protests around the country in response to Birmingham, mostly African Americans, just outraged by what happened there, and also by the conditions they lived under.
And the protests were mostly in the north
throughout, across the country, in urban areas. But it really—
Even the south, too.
The south, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the significant thing is, you know, by this time, half of African Americans live in the north. The consequences of the Great Migration. James Baldwin's noted famous book, The Fire Next Time, was published in January of 1963. And that really turned the attention of the country, tried to turn the attention of the country, to conditions in northern urban areas where people were segregated. So this fusion of the Southern protest, of King's emergence into this national celebrity, as you say, and America just waking up and seeing that this was an issue that could no longer be ignored.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the civil rights movement from two aspects, the key year of 1963 and that year's March on Washington when Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. We're visiting with a couple of great historians here. Leon Litwick is an historian and author. He won a Pulitzer Prize and the Francis Parkman Prize for his 1979 book, Been in the Storm So Long. And also here is Patricia Sullivan. She's a University of South Carolina scholar. She specializes in modern U.S. history. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, Leon, President Kennedy, it's 1963. He's only months from his own assassination, but he decides at this point to get involved. He's also moved by what he sees in Birmingham. What does he do? How significant a moment is this with the president getting involved here?
Well, what are you referring to in particular?
Well, he gives this big primetime speech and proposes some legislation, I think, in the aftermath of that.
I think he's becoming involved. I mean, it's taken some time.
He's not rushing, as people tend to think of John F. Kennedy when it comes to civil rights, is he?
No, I'm not sure where. I mean, Robert Kennedy's also dragged slowly into the movement. Perhaps Pat could say something more about that. But yes, they are becoming much more involved because of they're becoming much more involved because black people themselves have been mobilized to a much larger extent than they themselves had ever imagined. I mean, they had been very unhappy about this March on Washington proposal. They were embarrassed by it.
Embarrassed because?
Because the blame for it is likely to fall upon them for their failure to do things. And to that degree, to an extent, that's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Pat, your sense, just this idea of John F. Kennedy sort of dithering when it comes to the civil rights movement and really engaging, how accurate a view is that in your view?
Well, I think when you look at the political context of the period, you know, the power of Southern Democrats, the kind of things politicians are always weighing, right? You want it. And I think that the Kennedys were going slow, as you pointed out. I mean, weighing these various political pressures. Robert Kennedy, his Justice Department was extraordinary in terms of voting rights and being involved in a very basic way in the South in the early 60s, but not ready to push for national legislation. Birmingham does change that because the pressure is coming from another place. And they are concerned about conditions in northern urban areas. They see the national dimensions of America's race problem. And if you read Kennedy's speech, which you pointed out, June 11th, 1963.
This is the national television address you're talking about?
Which they decided very last minute. Yes, the national television
Very last minute. And
address.
He ends up sort of extemporaneously delivering some of that speech on primetime TV, no less.
And it is, I urge your listeners to read that speech. It's quite remarkable. He talks about 100 years of delay, looking back to the Emancipation Proclamation. He defines this challenge to America as a national challenge. And it is a remarkable speech that is conversant with right then. And as you point out, is the lead-in then to introducing civil rights legislation.
So it's fair to say then by mid-1963, the president is finally fully engaged here.
Yes, that is correct.
Took him a few years, but he's in the game.
But he got there.
Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Phil from Overland Park. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. Just wanted to make a comment first that I was in Washington a few years ago and went to the National Mall and didn't realize that there's a plaque on the steps showing exactly where Dr. King gave his speech.
Oh, the Lincoln Memorial you're talking about.
Yes, yes. And that was a very moving thing to look out over that vast mall and imagine what that was like in those years. The other thing is, the question I have is, where do your guests think that Dr. King would have ended up if he hadn't been killed? What were his aspirations and goals? Would he have gotten into politics? Would he have played? Obviously, he would have played a role in, you know, in the
right
in his group. But that's all. I'll take it off the air here.
Yeah, thank you for the good question, Phil. Leon Litwack, where was Martin Luther King headed in 1968 when he was gunned down?
Well, that's very hard to. I mean, one way in which I could answer that question. He looks around him, sees what's going on, and then he says, "You know, I'm tired of this patchwork of dealing with this problem by tinkering here and tinkering there.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we need is something much more ambitious than that." Much of the speech that he gave at the March in Washington was, in fact, J. Hoover understood it only so well, only too well, was actually the speech of a revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
That is, we're not going to tinker that much more. We have to start dealing with basics, and we have to start restructuring this entire society.
Mm-hmm.
We have to think in terms of changing, as I think he once said, the architecture of America, of how we think.
Mm-hmm.
That to leave things as they are now is not sufficient. We have to go much further.
Yeah.
And I think people misunderstand the talk on Washington in that respect. That is, yes, I have a dream. He had his dream. But as a number of deacons pointed out, hey, Martin, we've had that dream for a long time, the same dream.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's right. And something more was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking for that extra push, that extra compelling factor that would enable the movement to really operate at a different dimension than it was operating.
Yeah, Pat Sullivan, to go back to the caller's question, what's your sense of where King was headed in 68 when things came to an end?
I taking off from what Leon just said, you know, the movement had achieved enormous things. Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, which we're talking about right now, taking down Jim Crow segregation in the South. I think one of the extraordinary things about King's leadership and why the question is such an important one is that he kept moving. He looked at the deep problems that, you know, this history created, structural problems of poverty,
yes,
national problems.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, you have a week between the Voting Rights Act and the Watts riot. Dr. King goes to Chicago and really begins to grapple with these problems that are national, that are deep in our history. And of course, when he's assassinated, he's preparing for the Poor People's Campaign, you know, bring poor people to Washington and stay there, and really addressing issues that we talk about today. You look at the deep problems of poverty, unemployment, racial gaps. So I think Dr. King would have continued to address these issues continue to. You know, but he's left such a powerful legacy.
You know, our caller was wondering whether he would have gone into politics himself. Did you ever see him running for the U.S. Senate, for instance?
I don't think so, because Dr. King was someone who spoke the truth always. And he challenged us as Americans to live up to what we say we are.
And politics might not have served him very
well. No, because,
again,
we talked about the Kennedys. You've got to make some compromises. You have to work in that arena. And Dr. King was just, you know, so courageous in continuing to ask the tough questions and to hold us to account.
Well, we have to keep in mind also that there was another voice at the March on Washington that was also trying to be heard. That was the voice of John Lewis,
the congressman. Who's still in Congress from Georgia, yeah.
And he spoke just before Martin Luther King.
And gave a pretty good speech.
He gave a great speech. despite the efforts of the Kennedy administration and others to censor that speech. But he got enough into that into the speech that was given to alarm many observers. And he, the first thing he did is to say, look, there are a lot of people who are not here in this march.
Mm-hmm.
We should be embarrassed by the people who are not here. But they're very conspicuous. These are the very people who can't afford to come here. They can't even afford the transportation.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who are working 12 hours a day in some cases for hard, virtually no wages at all. There's a lot that needs taken care of, and we're not doing well at all on the economic front. And what he proposes in this speech certainly supports what King himself is turning toward.
Mm-hmm.
And that's turning toward a much more revolutionary approach to the whole problem.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the Civil Rights Movement. We'll turn to the March on Washington. We'll talk about the I Have a Dream speech, and we'll also talk about the Birmingham church bombing at the 16th Street Baptist Church. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. This hour, we're visiting with a pair of prominent civil rights historians about the year 1963 and King's immortal I Have a Dream speech. We're visiting with Leon Litwack. He's author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Been in the Storm So Long, The Aftermath of Slavery. And Patricia Sullivan, she's with the University of South Carolina. She specializes in U.S. history with an emphasis on African-American history. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. And again, Leon Litwack speaks at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza. Pat Sullivan speaks at 10 Friday morning at the same place. More information about these and all of these other events connected with this symposium, you can find that information at kclibrary.org. Well, let's move on in 1963, Pat, to Medgar Evers. He's murdered outside his home in June. His children are right inside the house. Who was Medgar Evers, and how was he murdered, and how did this shake things up?
Medgar Evers was one of the major civil rights leaders during this period, World War II veteran who returned to Mississippi and became the field secretary for the NAACP. Very, probably the most dangerous job in America during that period.
Yeah.
And, you know, by 63, as we've been talking, Mississippi was the sort of the center of so much of the activism. SNCC was there, CORE was there, people working on all fronts to challenge segregation and push on voting rights. And curiously, you know, Medgar Evers was driving home after a meeting the night that John F. Kennedy gave the famous speech and was gunned down in his driveway by Byron Delabecque with Klansmen.
Right across the street, he was apparently, and Evers wearing a bright white shirt, visible in the night, I guess, that evening. Yeah.
And his children up waiting for him, and, you know, it just is such an unbelievable moment. And, and again, punctuating. Here you have this wonderful speech, this turning towards civil rights, and then having this leader just gunned down in the driveway of his home. And so this is 63. It's all over the place. You know, very explosive time. And that was a tremendous loss, the assassination of Medgar Evers.
And again, as we talked at the start of this show, this continues a pattern of up and down developments when it comes to the civil rights movement in the year of 1963. You know, we talked with historian Taylor Branch, who wrote America in the King Years, that trilogy a couple of weeks back. And he talked about, you know, the upcoming the March on Washington, Leon, as we move to August of 63. And this concern throughout Washington, D.C. about all these marauding Negroes who would be descending on the city. The city bans liquor sales for the first time since Prohibition. What else did the city do to get ready for this onslaught of African Americans coming to Washington, D.C.?
Well, you made the obvious allusion to the stopping the sale of alcoholic beverages.
Yeah. Everyone's nervous. Everyone's uptight.
As though somehow that's going to massage the the otherwise a militant group ready to talk about politics and what has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of nervousness. There's a lot of concern that that you know black people are unrestrained. I mean, this mm-hmm. is the kind of stereotype that's often attached to their
and King
to
hopes
their reactions.
Leon, King hopes to do what with this March on Washington? What's the point?
He hopes to galvanize black opinion, mobilize black opinion, but also mobilize it to think beyond what he called the tinkering with the structure, the infrastructure. He wanted to talk about more, about broader plans, bolder plans. I mean, what is the March on Washington speech all about? It's about economic equality,
mm-hmm.
about political power. It's about affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
It's about affordable health care. And it's about a job that that pays a decent wage. Well, these have been real issues for many years, and they remain real issues today.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's not as though they came in with some new demands.
Mm-hmm.
It was trying to give some kind of impetus, some kind of push to the demands that have been out there for some time.
King's speech is so well known, I Have a Dream, but he winged that speech, at least partly. Yeah, tell us about that. How much was planned? How much was...
I don't recall
mm-hmm.
how much of it was. But I'd heard that much of the latter part of it was quite spontaneous, whereas the first part of the speech, he apparently seemed to have read most of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turned very spontaneously.
He was encouraged from people in the crowd,
That's
even Hilda Jackson, I think. Martin,
right.
You know, to tell him about the dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it was a kind of religious cadence, mm-hmm. with the cadence of a great black preacher. He does precisely that.
And that's the part, Pat, we remember so mm-hmm. well today.
Yeah.
That's right.
When he turned the spigot loose there a little bit. Yeah. Let's go back to some phone calls. 816-235-2888. Sonia from Gladstone. Good morning.
Good morning. I've been listening to the conversation. It's very good. But I believe President Kennedy was overrated. He could talk the talk, but he never walked the walk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was LBJ that passed, you know, the Civil Rights Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched both Martin Luther King. I watched Malcolm X. And I know my dad was very, very fond of King. But then I think my father even got tired of the rhetoric of, you know, just being the peace. It was time, he felt that it was time for black men, especially black men, to stand up and say, you know what, we're tired of being hit in the head. We're tired of the dogs chasing us. We're tired of being, you know, abused.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched my dad go between the peace-loving speeches of King, and then I also watched him change when Malcolm X came on the scene.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Great,
okay.
Great recollection, Sonia. Thanks so much for calling him in. You bet.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
In fact, that was summed up pretty well. The change in the mood was summed up pretty well by the notion that the Martin Luther King and his movement said, "We shall overcome," whereas the militants, the challengers, it's "We shall overrun."
Mm. Mm.
That you know, again, we're tired of the slow pace.
And there's this constant tension that as the movement goes along and King's adhering to nonviolence and more and more frustration with that approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is also, you know, we might mention, going back to what we talked about a few moments ago, about white people and Martin Luther King. Many whites and others are moving in that direction toward King, because someone like Malcolm X mm-hmm. scares the hell out of them,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and he is seen as a much safer. And so there's something about his speech that comforted whites.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about nonviolence. Well, of course, that comforts whites very, very much.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Malcolm X's rhetoric had somewhat a very different kind of impact and frightened many, many whites.
Jake from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Yeah, pleasant. Good morning, Steve and guests, and thanks for being on. You know, the thing that runs through my mind is a late middle-aged character. I'm 64. Grew up, you know, as a real young kid in the mid-60s at a major Catholic high school here in the metropolitan area. And the thing, I may have been oblivious to it, but it seemed there was a deafening silence among educators and from the pulpit at the time. Unless you were somewhere in the deep South, it was like, let's not even admit this is going on. It was my impression. I have to admit I'm a dunderhead now, and I was more dunderheaded as a kid, but you know, I had no sense of it, and it was the single most amazing, you know, movement in the history of the country. And like I say, my sense was the silence was deafening among educators in the pulpit, and I don't know. I may be wrong. I just,
Pat Sullivan,
you know,
as Jake's speaking, you're nodding your head.
Well, as someone who was in Catholic high school on Long Island during this period, that is such an important point, silence. I mean, that most people around the country, this was beyond their concern, beyond their vision. And I think we can – what people didn't know also, you know, how segregated our country has been and this sort of almost a willful ignorance. And again, it comes back to underscoring the importance of the moments we're talking about today that finally push this onto the national agenda. But even then, there's a tendency not to see it as your issue, right? Or see it as a Southern issue when really, I'm so glad the caller brought up Malcolm X. I mean, Malcolm X was on the scene. He took over the mosque in Harlem in 1954, the same year as Brown. Mm-hmm. And he has an audience, and his importance grows. And he is sort of a kind of a counterpoint, but also what Malcolm said, I'm the product of the northern white man, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that dimension of racial inequality that's grown up as people migrated north. So it's important to understand the point that the caller just made, that for many people, this was not on our the silences and the looking away and the not knowing.
Again, continuing with this pattern of up and down moments in 1963, Leon, then September of 63 comes and the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. What happened that day? And maybe most importantly, why did that happen? What was going on there?
Well, there had been a great deal of agitation throughout Birmingham, as we've talked about that during the earlier part of this program. Birmingham was ready for something, or wasn't ready for something, actually, as it turned out. That there would be more trouble, I think, was obvious. That it would take this form, and that it would claim the lives of children. Four black girls, in this case, was a shock to the system. It was a shock for whites and a shock for blacks as well.
This shakes up the country.
It does. It does indeed. The images of that bombing, the images of those four girls, Spike Lee's film later demonstrates it has a tremendous impact.
You know, I'm just wondering, as the two of you, Pat, you know, look back on the life of Martin Luther King, what strikes you the most about him, you know, and the contribution, you know, the tremendous contributions he made? That is no longer a question, of course, of any kind. But what strikes you the most about this man? You spent so much time studying him and how he operated. What impressions would you leave us with?
His courage.
Really?
And I think, you know, his capacity for growth. I mean, after the 64 Act and the 65 Act, he could have retired and taken, you know, much credit and
the laws
satisfaction.
Changed. Things are okay now. I'm done.
But the issue of racial justice, of economic justice, of social justice, he continued to move and look as the layers peeled away, as important change came, and seeing the deeper problems that our country faced because of our history. So to me, that's quite extraordinary, his capacity to continue growing and leading till the very end of his life.
Pat picks courage.
I would add to that. I think one of his most courageous moments is the moment when he denounces the war in Vietnam. Mm. Because nobody's doing that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people are doing that at that time.
And that took
considerable courage because he did not have full support within his own community. And there are many who are ready to forsake him. There are many who are ready to abandon him. But he stuck with that. And he not only did he denounce the war, but the way in which he denounced it.
Mm-hmm.
What were his famous words, Pat? That we had become the tormentors, but the
purveyors of violence.
The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today.
And of course, this severs his relationship with President Johnson, and Johnson feels betrayed. He's done so much. He feels for King and for the movement, and now King's turning his back on this incredibly important issue to Johnson, which is Vietnam.
Yeah.
We have a phone call on this point here. Chester from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning, Chester.
Good morning. I was an active member of the CORE chapter here at Kansas City, Kansas.
Yeah.
And right on the day of the March on Washington, the grand jury was meeting on us because we had been demonstrating in front of a federal building. And supposedly we were picketing to intimidate a judge. I would just like to comment on the March on Washington. I don't think I've heard any comments about John Lewis in his speech, which he had to tone his speech down. Mm. Dr. King and had talked to him, but the only person who he agreed to do this for was A. Philip Randolph. Mm. Also, I was glad to hear the comments that was made here about the speech, Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam. Mm. Some of us who were intimately involved in the civil rights movement, and we felt that this was his greatest speech, and particularly the part that he stated, that I finally decided to take my religion seriously.
Mm-hmm.
That part of his speech, I think, kind of really tells who King was. I pondered that question. But there was a lot of things going on all over the country. Just one last comment is that before King died, he was preparing for the Poor People's March.
Right.
Never forget that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have not... We don't hear anything about poor people now.
Yeah.
And so just want to make those comments. Thank you.
He made it very clear that this would be a revolutionary army of white and black poor, not just black poor.
Mm-hmm. We're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank the great historian Leon Litwack for being here and also Pat Sullivan. Thank you both for coming in today. We sure appreciate it. Again, you can hear Leon tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library on the plaza. Pat Sullivan speaks at 10 tomorrow morning in the same place. More information about all this, all these events connected with this symposium, kclibrary.org. Thank you both very much for coming today.
Thank
Such
you.
A pleasure
Thank
to you. Have you.